Sometimes it's hard to know where we're going without a roadmap, so I'm going to start with a little bit of a roadmap. Here's a quick one. We have started a lesson on rethinking prayer, and the lesson's going to unfold in three major sections. Part one is going to be the prerequisite mindset and the prerequisite practices to this new prayer narrative, and that is to disentangle from the ego as self. Part two is going to be rethinking how we pray in this new prayer narrative. And part three is going to be prayer practices that we often don't think of as prayer practices that are very meaningful in this new narrative. And so each one of those three sections is kind of lengthy. So to help us hang in there all the way to the end, I wanted to give a brief picture right up front. So we started with an introductory lesson, and that's what we've done the last 3 weeks, is an introductory lesson to the whole thing, which is three lessons. You understand how that's working? So what we did during the introduction is we dipped our toes into the idea of reframing our praying for other people kind of prayer. And my hope was, by seeing kind of where this will go at the end, you get a picture that makes sense for the beginning and the middle. So today we are beginning the first of the three lessons, and here's the part you need a roadmap for. The last 3 weeks were an introduction. And today, we're going to be introducing the first lesson. So, when I stand up today and say, today is the introduction, you might be thinking to yourself, hey, he just did an introduction, so I want to make sure it's very clear. Today is the second introduction, but it is the first introduction to the first lesson. You see, that's how it's going. So, in this first lesson, we're going to talk about the first step in this new prayer narrative. Something that I say pretty regularly here is that our lives are being put into upheaval at this moment in history. Our most basic instincts about the nature of reality are being turned inside out. So, of course, things that we build on top of those basic instincts about reality are getting shaky and are starting to crumble around us, and in particular, the story we tell ourselves about prayer. As we're coming to grips with this new world that we live in, we realize some things about it. It is a world of illusion. Plato suggested as much in his parable of the cave, 3,000 years ago, something like that, 20-something years ago. And the quantum physicists are now coming along and saying the same thing. I put my stuff on this lectern as though it's a solid thing. But every child who goes through chemistry now knows this is not a solid thing. This is just pulsating energy. But I relate to it as though it's a solid thing. And all of a sudden, I start to realize that the world as it is and the world as I perceive it are not always the same. It's like the world as I perceive it is a shadow world that is broadcast from a fire behind me, as in Plato's parable. It is a world in which time bends and reality bends. It's a world in which two things can be at the same place, or two things can be in different places at the same time. How does that work in our world? It's a world in which certitude is gone. And what that means is that we're having to rethink our most fundamental instinctive narratives about stuff, about the way the world is. And that applies most of all to our stories of ultimacy, which are often our religion stories, our spirituality stories. So we're having to rethink our story about God, and we're thinking our story about what it means to be human. Are we thinking our story of Jesus and sin and salvation and the afterlife? You know, somebody should write a book about that. There are six of them left. And as we rethink our narrative of prayer, the starting point is this. We stopped praying, many of us. But we did so for a couple of reasons. First, because our God changed. In the old framework, God used to be a very limited metaphor. We had one in our minds, and it was almost always a humanoid metaphor. God in our minds was a father, or a king, or a judge, or a friend, or a lover. It was some version of some significant relationship that we had had in our lives that we could use as a comparison, as a metaphor, to say, relating to God is kind of like this. And so we used these human-like metaphors for speaking of God and thinking about God. But the further we walk on the spiritual journey, as our understanding of the basic reality in which we live is being upended, we've needed to expand our ways of thinking about God. We've needed to expand our metaphors for God. Our earliest spiritual teachers, they had a whole bevy of alternative metaphors to give us, lots of tradition from which to draw. But we have found here in our community, as we've had these discussions, others as well, that using the four Greek elements, those have been fertile territory for mining views of God, ways of thinking about God. God as wind, that is that you cannot contain wind, but you can stand in the midst of it and experience. God as earth, we did a whole lesson on thinking of God as the soil in which we are rooted. God as water, a river that flows that we can be in and be carried with, or that we can stand outside of and stay on the banks. God as fire that we can draw near to and be warmed, or we can stand back. We begin to think of God in these different kinds of ways. Together as a community, we've imagined God as a song with a downbeat of the virtues of the divine life. We've imagined God as a gravitational pull. And so we're rethinking some of our most fundamental understandings of the spiritual life, the spiritual journey, and we've begun to rely less heavily on our God as a human-like metaphors. And so we began to explore other ways of telling the story about God, and we find that the prayer practices and the prayer story that we hammered out while we were thinking of God in humanoid form kind of stopped working. When our ways of thinking about God are in transition, our ways of thinking about prayer are also in transition. And the sign that this transition is afoot is simply this: we just kind of stopped praying. We never intentionally decided to stop praying. It just kind of happened for many of us. But I also suggested last week that it is not only our changing ways of thinking about God that are changing the way that we think about prayer. It's also the changing ways that we are thinking about ourselves. Only part of our prayer problem has been how we think about God. The other part has been how we think about self. We have prayed to one metaphor of God, but we have prayed from a metaphor for ourselves. How do we think about being us? Which means that if you think about self this way, you're going to pray that way. And if you change the way that you think about yourself, you're going to change the way you think about prayer. So, I said last week, the me that does the praying in the old metaphor is the me that has been called the false self, or the ego as self, or what the Bible called self as flesh, as opposed to self as spirit. And when we grant that version of self, that's got to be so embarrassing, Wendy. Now, come on over. We'll find a seat. Here, there's a place right here. You can come on. You've already flipped off the lights, so, I mean, it's not going to get any more embarrassing than that. So, think of that version of self having the change dynamic that we hold prayer has, or when we think of that version of self having the power dynamic that we hold is resident in prayer, all of a sudden we begin to think, really? Is that really true? So when I uploaded these lessons, in the last three lessons, the introductory part to the podcast, the title was, Do Reasonable People Still Pray? ? And then, really? ? Because when I am the me that I cobble together in this world to make the world work for me, when I am the me that is not perhaps the truest version of me, and I pray as that version of me, it begins to get uncomfortable, sometimes bordering on ridiculous, and you hear people around watching us, and they find it a mockable thing that we do. Well, I don't think prayer has become mockable, but I really resonate with what they're saying. But I think more likely it's that we can no longer believe that the false self is a viable agent for the things that prayer purports to do. The false self, we can no longer hold that as a viable agent for the things that prayer purports to do. The brain-body instincts that we talked about these last weeks, the story that is woven together by our five senses and our one brain, the story that we intuit as we are young, that we are discrete and separate packages of being. When we believe that that is the self that really is, and we believe that that is the self that is affecting the kind of change that we say prayer affects, well, that is why many people are losing their hold with prayer. And that's what leads us to this first lesson about rethinking prayer. The first step of prayer in this new narrative is to help us deconstruct the self that we are. Now, I call it a new narrative, but what we're going to see through the course of this lesson is it's actually a very old narrative. It's actually rooted in our most ancient tradition, and it's rooted in our most ancient texts. The first step of prayer as we rethink our prayer narrative is to help us step back from a limited version of self. It's to help us step back from the self that our five senses and one brain have constructed for us. The first step of prayer as we rethink our prayer narrative is to transcend the instincts about self that have informed our lives and have informed particularly our way of thinking about prayer. I was speaking to a man recently who was on the cusp of a great leap forward in his personal growth. You know someone is on the cusp of a great leap forward when they say that the things that have always worked for them have stopped working. And so what he said was, you know, I can get people to like me. I really can. I can win people over like nobody's business. In the town where I grew up, everybody loves me. I'm the envy of many men. I'm the object of desire for many women. People respect me. People admire me. I mean, what am I doing here talking to you, Doug? What am I even complaining about? Because what I have is what everybody wants. What I set out to get in my life, I have gotten. But the truth is, I'm suffocating over here. I'm suffocating under the burden of getting people to like me. It's hard work getting people to respect you. I spend all my days thinking about what people think about me. I spend all of my days distorting myself into some kind of a contorted version of what I think it would be to be the person that people like. And, he said, the thing is, I'm really good at it. I have configured myself to be the man that people like, and now they like me. It worked, and I'm dying over here. I can't even tell when I'm doing it. Everything I do, everything I say, the way that I conform my facial expressions, the way that I raise an eyebrow, every tailored response is all part of a deeply embedded and concerted strategy that people like. And so now they like me, and my life isn't working. I can't even tell when I'm doing it because everything I do, everything I say, every one of those tailored responses is all part of that strategy, and no one knows who I really am. I'm not sure I know who I really am, but being this version of me is killing me. I can't keep up the pace. Knowing and being known, we talk about that. Yeah, I don't do that. I've worked really hard to get people to approve of me, but I'm not sure people know me. I get people to like me so that I can like me. I get people to like me so I can make it in the world, and it is not working. I can't even love women, not really, I keep finding myself in the kind of relationship where they want me more than I want them, which is not fulfilling, but it sure does fill that like me need I've got going. And I can't relate to older men. I'm always wondering if they approve or don't approve. I always worry about my interaction with my peers. It's a way to live that is sick, and I don't like it. Now, as he was telling the story, all of his facial expression and everything spoke of misery, which makes me feel particularly discompassionate or uncompassionate, because I'm thinking, this is great. This is fantastic. Because when someone can articulate things as well as he did, well begun is half done. The ability to stand outside of the false self and to be able to describe it with that much clarity and to be able to be so thoroughly sick of that version of self that is the same self, by the way, that has gotten me all of my success and gotten me all of the favor that I've gotten in my life, that is a man who is on the cusp of growth. I want you to recall this from a lesson that we did last fall. We were talking about rethinking the Holy Spirit. It's important to have this framework in mind as we approach the first step of prayer in this rethought prayer narrative. Because in this form of prayer, the very first step is going to be to pick up an ancient basket of tools that we have been given that help us transcend the false self. The false self is deeply married to daily life reality. We saw that the last 3 weeks. The false self was born in daily life reality. It was hammered out in the world of length and width and height. It was hammered out in a world of sight and sound and touch and taste. The false self was born in daily life reality. It took shape as our brains first began to weave together a narrative about reality. And that narrative became, I am me, and that is not me. It started with mother, and particularly mother's breast. I am me, and I'm hungry. Breast is other, and it gives me what I yearn for. And right there, we begin to create a reality in which separate, distinct entities exist, of which I am but one. And so we hammered out a narrative that made life work in this world of length and width and height. It works for us. And based on that narrative, based on that self that we began to create at a very early age, we were able to eat and to learn to crawl and to learn to walk and to learn to survive. That narrative worked for us. We created a self that took root deep within our consciousness, and despite all the science that says everything is connected, and despite all the earliest spiritual teachers who have long taught us that everything is connected, we began to feel very disconnected. We became our disconnected, separated, making it alone version of me. We became deeply attached to our I am this Enneagram type, I have these natural aptitudes, I do these things version of self. But again, the false self did help us get here. But it acted like a booster stage on a rocket. We are here because the false self got us here. We did eat. That's good. We did crawl. We did differentiate. We did go to school. We did go to get a job. We did have kids. We did the things, all the stuff that helped us get where we are, and we did it using the narrative of this persona self that we created. Thank God for the booster rocket that got us here. But also, like a booster rocket, after it has done what it needed to do, after it has gotten us here where we are, it needs to fall away, or it is going to impede us getting where we are created to go. So again, the false self, or the ego as self, or the flesh self, is deeply rooted in daily life reality. They're in this section of reality. As a matter of fact, the false self has some anxiety about the deeper life reality because stuff happens there that the ego cannot control. It's better to stay away from that deeper life reality, thank you very much. But that's not the wisdom of our tradition. The working hypothesis of our tradition, the hypothesis that has a rich, varied layers of experience, the experiences of our ancient saints and our sages and the devout who have gone before us, their working hypothesis is this: there is a deeper life reality. There is something bigger than this world of touch and feel and sight and sound. It is a reality in which everything is connected. It is a reality in which we work with oneness more than we work with two-ness. It is a world in which I am in God and of God, and God is in and of me. Two things are in fact one thing. It's a world in which, as Paul taught us, that we, being many, are one body. Every one of us members one of the other. Two things are in reality more one than two. It's a reality in which a connectedness model of prayer works and a disconnectedness model of prayer does not work. The prayer practices that we'll look at in this lesson have been hammered out over the centuries to help blur the boundary between daily life reality and deeper life reality. The prayer practices that we'll be talking about in this lesson are a quest to swim in the deeper life reality, a quest to be fully awakened to deeper life reality. This is the starting point for prayer in this reconsidered prayer narrative. Your and my true self lives in deeper life reality. The deeper you and the deeper me lives beyond the five senses in the one brain. That part of us lives in the reality that the saints and mystics have attested to for centuries, that scientists are now giving us language to talk about, the truer version of reality. And so the first set of prayer practices in this rethought way of praying are called prayers of detachment. They are designed to help you and to help me step back from our instincts, step back from our intuitions about the way things are, to step back from the ego as self, to step back from the thoughts that we have in our mind that we picked up when we were first dealing with self and breast, and we were distinguishing and separating and coming to these discrete packages. It's to step back from all of those deeply ingrained instincts. And they are prayers and they are practices that help us step back from all the symptoms of living in that narrative. Let me read for you one of these prayers. It comes from John of the Cross. Deliver me from the desire of being loved. Deliver me from the desire of being extolled. Deliver me from the desire of being praised and preferred and consulted and approved and popular. And deliver me from fear, from the fear of being humiliated or of being despised or of being rebuked, forgotten, wronged, ridiculed. Deliver me from the fear that others may be loved more than I. Now, there is nothing wrong with being loved. That is part of the human experience. There's nothing wrong with being honored. That, too, is part of this human experience. There's nothing wrong with being praised or being consulted. There's nothing wrong with not being humiliated. These are good and healthy parts of the human life. But the spiritual life, and on the spiritual journey, the false self often takes these healthy parts of human life and promotes them to a level that gives them more power than they merit. Because what happens is we are propping up a construct that says, I am valuable because I really don't think I am. And in the process of constructing this self that says, this is how I'm going to be valuable, when something comes along and pokes that, we have a strong reaction because at the core, we don't believe it anyway. We don't believe that I am in God and of God and cannot be more precious than I am. We don't believe that. Because when we hammered out our separate and distinct worldview at a very young age, we all of a sudden said, there is not me. That's the goodness of God. And then there is me. We begin to live these discrete separate packages, and so consequently, to compensate for that, we had to build a false version of self. And so, when I live in this lesser version of me. I am limiting myself to the story that was constructed, woven together by my five senses and my one brain. When I detach from that, when I step back from the need to be honored and appreciated and savored, when I step back from that, I'm detaching from the lesser version of me. I begin to live in, I begin to accustom myself to the reality that is so ancient, that I am of God and we are parts one of another. God is in me. And when that happens, I don't have to spend my life worrying that people don't like me. I don't have to spend my life reacting against those things that every one of us react to, because I don't have that narrative anymore. I don't have to spend my days making sure that I don't lose my job or that I don't lose my house. I don't have to spend my life making sure that I keep all the variables under control, because who knows what might happen if I don't. I don't have to do that. Because I'm doing those things because of the intolerable angst of being human. Some part of me knows that I am connected to divine life. Some part of me knows that my proper home is in deeper life reality. And yet my brain-body story tells me that I am not, that I am separate from God, that I am separate from you. And I feel that separateness, even though some part of me knows it is not so. But the part of me that tells me it is so real. And that disconnect gives rise to an interior sense of panic, an existential angst that I have inside, this intolerable dilemma of being. And so we have to cope. And we cope by creating a false self to help us get by. And then, like my friend who is just getting sick of his false self, we begin to suffocate under the weight of the falseness. And so the wisdom of old is that the first step in prayer is the prayer of detaching from that self. It is the prayer that helps us detach from our brain-body instincts that we all picked up, detach from our two-ness narrative, detach from our separate-from-God narrative. This kind of insight, this kind of awareness is the product of the prayers of detachment that we'll look at in this lesson. These are prayers that invite us to a new kind of life. Now, these kinds of prayers used to be reserved for the rarefied few, the saints. Throughout our tradition, when people have talked about this kind of prayer, they've usually lived in a cloistered community somewhere. Monastic communities, living in a convent somewhere. And even there was a little bit too much community, so there was often the hermits who went and withdrew way out to the cave or to an acolyte on the side of a building somewhere. These were the ones that used to talk about this kind of prayer. It was reserved for the rarefied few. The mystics, those who lived outside the camp, the outliers, the super spiritual ones, the zealots, those are the ones that talked this way. But something's happening for us living in the 21st century as we do, and that is that our worldview is beginning to catch up with the mystics. Now, the mainstream can see what the mystics were talking about. They've been talking about it for a long time. They had this really incredible capacity for insight. They saw something that most couldn't see, and so we put them out there on the fringe, but now the worldview has caught up, and we can see what they were talking about. In our lifetimes, oneness is seeming more wise and more true than two-ness. And that's becoming accessible now to ordinary working people. Our cultural worldview is changing. Our societal worldview is changing. Science is bending time and bending truth. Particles are going to places, and we're loosening our grip on a separateness way of being. And we can now hear what the mystics were talking about when they talked about a connectedness way of being. And ordinary people can access that kind of oneness. Ordinary moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas can intuit deeper life reality. Ordinary teenagers, ordinary kids, this kind of wisdom now belongs in the grocery shopping, errand running part of life. It becomes a normative part of life because we can tell that's not a solid table. Because we can tell that's not a solid table, we know we live in a world in which we don't have the whole picture. What used to be rarefied wisdom, rarefied spiritual experience, is now accessible to the middle of the bell curve. What a great time to be alive. What a great time to be Christian. As we realize that this is an experienceable, attainable way of being human. All of a sudden, the ancient wisdom makes more sense. The ancient practices, the ancient rhythm of detaching from the false self, detaching from the limits of daily life reality, these ancient ways of prayer begin once again to make sense. We'll see in this lesson that the prayers of detachment break into three categories. Prayers that help us detach from stuff. Stuff has such a powerful sway over us. Stuff is so bound to the false self that to detach from stuff is in many ways... We really have ordered the new microphone we have. The first kind of prayer of detachment is detaching from the power of stuff, because stuff is so interwoven with the false self that to separate one is really to weaken the other. The second kind of prayer of detachment is to detach from the story that we tell ourselves. The truths that we tell that are often not true. These are the prayers of self-awareness, often associated with self-disclosure. And the third kind of prayer of detachment is to detach from the past and from the future. Detach from borrowing regrets from the past and borrowing anxiety from the future. So detaching from the power of stuff, detaching from the power of our stories, and detaching from the power of time. And these prayer practices, those who have gone before us teach, free us from the power of the false self. They free us from this inordinate attachment that we have to daily life reality. And they help us rewire our intuitions. And when we have rewired our intuitions, we see. I can see it. I see what they've been talking about. We can feel it. Oh, that's what that means. I really am connected to divine life. This is what that means from an experiential basis. I look within and I do sense the divine presence. That seems so ordinary. Oh, that's what we're talking about. And when I do, who knew? God really is good, and I really am safe. It was my deep attachment to the false self reality that ever made that an issue. And wow, that really changes the story I tell myself about praying for Tricia. So, we'll pick up there next week. And Lord, as we have prayed in concert with the disciples of old, please teach us to pray. In Jesus' name, amen.